pieces of metal, whatever you like, and the elements and shapes are made out of coat hanger wire, you can very inexpensively build a fairly high performance, fairly long Yagi. A well-tuned Yagi on VHF repeater. Time out. A well-tuned Yagi on VHF is going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar, the biggest bang per pound, the biggest pound, biggest bang per square foot of wind load. It's a very high-performance antenna, when properly tuned, when properly built. And it doesn't have to be expensive. So with those deep notches you got between the main lobes and the side lobes of a well-tuned Yagi, I personally have had local interference guys that used to give me grief. And by carefully swinging the antenna back and forth to drop that interfering signal into one of those notches, I could knock him down by 30 decibels. That's a 1,000-to-1 power ratio. And therefore, the signal-to-interference ratio improved tremendously. You're going to get more out of the Yagi than a dipole in that service, in my opinion. They both will work. I think one's going to work a hell of a lot better, John. KC2WGV, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KD2CM2 with a quick question.
CM2, start off with your name and go right ahead with your question.
Yes, Dick, it's Neil. I just wanted that website again.
Okay, you want the website. All right. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo.com. You go to that website. The first page is the printed circuit antennas that Kent is selling. The second page, or you go to one of the things you can click on the side, he has the very inexpensive, whatever he calls them, cheap Yagis or coat hanger wire Yagis. And by the way, he owns the patent on that very simple driven element. The driven element looks like half of a folded dipole feed. At first you look at that and say, hey, that can't work. It works like a charm, and he owns the patent that describes how to do that. And so he's right. So you need a fill on that one then, Neil. KD2CM2, K2LIW.
Thanks, Nick. KD2CM2, back to net.
Okay, good luck with that one. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, yeah, that's a good point. He probably has more than one direction that he's getting that signal from. If he has a single direction, it might work well. But if not, he's going to have to go for a Yagi. So, yeah, I think that answers his question well. Let me let him drop the talk one for a second. Okay, we have a question here. Gentleman has acquired an old vector network analyzer, an HP, and it's a nice little one, and he has a question about using it. What he's doing, he has three ports. He has the tracking generator output, he has the sample port in, and then he has the signal port. So now he comes out of the tracking generator port and he goes to a splitter. One part of that splitter goes into the sample port. The other part is going into, right now he's using a directional coupler. Directional coupler is connected to the antennas he's working on. But the problem is his sample port is, he only has one directional coupler and it's minus 40 dB. Not enough signal to drive the VNA. His question is, in place of that coupler, can he use a key in the same fashion? And if he marks it up and calibrates it with his standard devices, will that work and can he rely on it? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there I'm not sure. And I worry about something here. And that is, you've got to be very careful on many vector network analyzers where the sampling port is really a very carefully designed set of sampling diodes, where the sampling diodes are running at the peak picosecond rate in the time domain and the very amplitude sensitive. In other words, when you read the data sheet on your vector network analyzer, I don't know the exact number, but there's some number like, I'm going to call it minus 10 or 0 dBm. You can't exceed that power level on the sampling port without damaging those sampling diodes. You got to be careful about that. So with the power that come out of the tracking generator into a T connector, there's a chance you're going to exceed that range.
But the T connector is only going to replace the directional coupler, not the splitter out of the tracking generator.
Okay. The splitter on the tracking generator has two outputs. Where do those two outputs go, John? Go ahead.
Okay, out of the tracking generator into the splitter. One output of the splitter goes into the sample port, which is usually the way it goes. Then you have the signal coming out of the coupler that has to go to your device. Now, you could put it through a directional coupler. If he had a minus 10 dB, that would be fine. He'd get enough signal out of it. But he doesn't. So he wants to put that into a T, bridge the T into the signal input, use the other side of the T after calibration to connect his antenna to.
Okay, if I take all the information you're giving me from the beginning, there's something wrong here, John. You got a tracking. You told me the vector network analyzer has three ports. One of them is called tracking generator output. One of them is called sample port. And I guess the other one is called receiver port. Okay, the tracking generator output goes to a T. One of the outputs of the T goes to the sample port. One of them goes to the directional coupler. The directional coupler straight through port goes to the device on the test. And now the directional coupler output, where does that go? Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Okay, I'll describe it again. The directional coupler, the negative 40 dB port, goes to the signal input, the signal he's looking to put into the vector network analyzer. Okay, he's only using one T. He wants to use one T and one splitter instead of a splitter and a directional coupler. So we'll go from the tracking generator into a splitter. The splitter will feed the sample port. The other port of the splitter will now go to a T, which will feed the signal input, the signal he's looking at, and the device under test.
If that right there's listening, KE2EJ or WA2CDL, Andy, I just received a report that the Echo Link tonight seems not to be operational, and maybe there's something that can be corrected there. So the Echo Link might not be operational. I would say it's impossible to use a T in that manner, John. However, I'm concerned that the T gives you very poor impedance matching. Your tracking signal generator, in many cases, is far from 50 ohms. By way of the splitter, you're going to see some of that mismatch. The T connector itself is another mismatch, which is going to be seeing 25 ohms instead of 50. To properly calibrate that and get reasonable answers is not going to be easy. I'd much rather see him use a real directional coupler for that last port that goes to the device on the test. And even if he's using a directional coupler that's not rated for that frequency region, so assume now he's making a measurement at 144 megacycles, and he's got a 10 decibel directional coupler that's rated for 400 megacycles. That could work like a charm, because the calibration procedure takes out the fact that the directional coupler is supposed to be 10 dB at 400 megs, and maybe it's going to be 20 dB at 144 megs, and it's going to be slanting at 6 dB per octave. Those are minor details. I'd much rather see him use a real directional coupler. And even if it's far outside of the frequency region, where he's using it at a lower frequency than rated, higher frequency gets a little bit better. In other words, If it's rated for 50 megs and is using it at 144, that's the wrong direction. If the directional coupler is rated for 400 and is using it at 144, at a lower frequency repeater, time out.
BXO via
Echo Link.
You guys are
our partner. Okay, BXO and Echo Link. Sounds like Echo Link is working. Very glad to hear that. So as long as you're using it at a frequency lower than the rating of the directional coupler, it should work like a charm. I'd much rather see him go get a real directional coupler of any frequency higher than where he needs it or the right frequency. Because when you look back into the output port of the directional coupler, the main thing you're going to see is the output of the splitter. If the splitter is well designed, it presents a very close to 50 ohm source. To put a T connector there, schematically looks right. You're getting signals flowing in what you think is the right direction. But the T connector is so far from 50 ohms, it's very close to 25 ohms, and you use it in that manner. And I worry about the amplitudes of the signals being too high. I won't say it's impossible. I don't recommend it. You can see where I'm going in this one and why I'm going that way, John. I've used now vector network analyzers day in and day out for the last 11 years, and I've developed a pretty strong feeling for what does and doesn't work well on a vector network. So back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2YIW.
Okay, Dick. So the recommendation is, even though you can't use that minus 40 dB coupler, you should get another coupler. And there are minus 10 dBs out there, and they're not that expensive. And he's working below 500 megahertz, so getting a coupler, a directional coupler to fit that should not be difficult at all. But I agree. I wouldn't like to see him do it with a T, even though his inputs and outputs on those circuits are adjustable. He can attenuate the signals down. I think he'll get a much more reliable system doing it that way. Okay, very good. Let me see if I have another one.
Yeah, let me add a couple of words on this one, John. Stand by a second. And now, although the website has been drastically changed, there is a website called K5RMG, K5 Roadrunners Microwave Group from Texas, which up until 6 months or so ago, they had a series of articles by K2RIW. When you go to their technical article page, their first page, and you go to the square called Technical Articles, and then on the technical articles, the bottom of that page is the so-called K2RIW corner. One of those 10 articles there gives you 1,500 words of explanation of directional couplers being used for standing wave measurements and power directional measurements. But that 1,500-word article, a number of people have fallen in love with it because it gave them a lot of information that the normal books don't tell you about calibrating, using directional couplers, sometimes far outside of the frequency region, and it gives you a technique for taking your yucky directional coupler of mediocre performance, and at least at one frequency at a time, you can put an external device on the directional coupler to make its directivity, which might be only 20 dB, you can make the directivity go to 50 dB if you want to. A very desirable characteristic. The article tells you how to do that. Now, as I said, k5rmg.org, that website, up until 6 months ago, had these beautiful articles. They redesigned their website. They've eliminated these articles. If you use the so-called Wayback file, in other words, there's a way you can go to a website which will show you past performance of certain websites. You go to the Wayback file and you go to k5rmg.org, you will find those articles, and I'd recommend you read them, because some people jumped up and down with joy after finding that article. K5RMG. So once again, and it's under k5rng.org. And by way of a Wayback file, you will be able to find it. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Oh, you're absolutely right about those articles, Dick. I'm one of them that fell in love with them. I've read them and I learned a lot about directional couplers and how to use them properly. Great stuff. All right. I have one more question. Let me let it drop. Okay. I have a young gentleman who has a basic, a small pre-amplifier. It only has 70 dB gain. And it has NPN transistors. He discovered one of the transistors is shorted, and he wants to replace it. And he has a bunch of NPN transistors that look similar. Now, he's wondering if a Radio Shack blister pack transistor, which is basically what he has, being that it's such a low signal device, and he knows how to base it out, do you think he has any problem in just putting any transistor in there, any NPN transistor? Can he do any damage, and what should he look out for? What's your recommendations on that thing? Over to you.
Okay, there's two things you said that confuse me. I think you said the word preamplifier, and I think you said only 70 decibels of gain. Wow. The average preamplifier we put in front of our rigs has 18 to 22 dB of gain. 70 decibels of gain is a big number. Question number one, are you sure? Second of all, you didn't tell me what frequency range. I mean, if he's building a preamplifier or repairing a preamplifier that's being used on 14 megacycles, that's one thing. If this preamplifier is being used on 1296, that's something very different. So run by again. Preamplifier, yes or no, because there was a little bit of a dropout there. He said it. 70 decibels, run that by again. And what frequency is this thing operating at, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, that's what he's claiming that it's 70 dB gain. It's audio preamp. 70 dB. And it is a 40 kilohertz and below. So it's really, I think any general NPN will cover that.
Now that we know that it's audio, 40 kilohertz makes a big difference. And I guess I should have realized that 70 decibels of gain. Nobody builds an RF amplifier, preamplifier with that amount of gain. Whereas audio, yes, they do. And so, in the case of a preamplifier, particularly if it's the one going to, let's say, a magnetic pickup of an old-fashioned phonograph record pickup, magnetic pickups, there the only thing you worry about is NPN versus PNP is minor. The bubble pack transistors, 2N, what is it now, 444, I think is one of the very popular, I can't remember the, one of the popular numbers of these little plastic case transistors where you can get a zillion of them for like 10 cents a piece, and 95% of them are going to work like a charm. The only thing you got to worry about is noise figure. Occasionally, the very first transistor at the front end of a audio preamplifier is going to give you some extra hissing noise. And it's not a showstopper. It's just an annoyance. And it's something that you can definitely eliminate by the fact that you can buy so many of these transistors so cheaply. In the case of Radio Shack, what they tend to do is go to the manufacturer of those transistors, and they take the production run of the devices that fell out of some tight specification, too high or too low a beta gain, too high or too low a leakage resistance, and things like this, leakage current. And so these transistors, the good news is they're inexpensive. The good news is that 95% of them are quite good. 5% of them are not going to be so good. Let me drop. And so it's not a very difficult thing for you to do, to simply pick one up, try it, and if you find out the gain is a little higher or lower than you want, the current is a little higher or lower than you want, you're not willing to readjust the bias resistor, or the noise power, the hiss noise in the background, or the crackling noise is a little bit higher. The fact that they're so inexpensive and you bought a plastic package of 10 of them, don't be afraid to unplug the first one and plug in the second one. You'll eventually find a good one that'll do the job, in my opinion. So that's the pros and cons of buying inexpensive transistors in that manner. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Let it drop for our friend. Okay, Dick, that's KC2WQB. Very good. Yeah, I think you could give it a try, and he has quite a few. He was just a little timid of throwing them in there. He doesn't know how to base them out or identify them, so I don't think I have any problem with that. All right, I think it's about time to go over to Paul. Maybe he has some word on how the astronauts are making out with that leak on the space station. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I bet he does. So I do recommend for anybody who's interested in space to get a hold of the, I'm looking at it right now, I'm trying to find out what month it is. The front cover doesn't tell me.
Huh.
I'm guessing it's the May issue. I may have to look inside to find out. I'm talking about Sky Intelligator, it's June issue. The June 2013 issue of Sky and Telescope magazine, which is on your newsstands these days, and Barnes & Noble and places like that. It's got a beautiful article about that comet or asteroid that that landed in Russia in the town of Chelyabinsk. Chelyabinsk. It's called the Chelyabinsk Super Meteor. Beautiful article. Tells you about velocity, direction of arrival, why it was being confused with the other near-Earth asteroid on the exact same day, but 16 hours different, very different direction of arrival. Tells you how fast it was moving, how many pounds it was, how many kilotons of TNT equivalent, why people discovered all this damage, and so on. And the fact that it's roughly a once-per-100-year event, but there's more of them on the way. What should we do to defend against them? Rather good article. I do recommend you read it. Over to you, Paul. And how has that, let me think, it's called an ammonia leak, I think they had on a pump. And hopefully that the spacewalk they did was able to cure that. Let's see if it was. From US2N, a space expert. And by the way, repeat your email address one more time, Paul, so that people who want to ask you other space questions will know how to get to WS2N. If your email address is not already on QIZ.com, WS2N, take it. K2LAW in the set now.
Hello,
if you're able to hear me, and you may have to go through the eastern input. And by the way, once again, for those who are hearing noises that shouldn't be there, please go to the reverse mode of your receiver and carefully write down what signal strength you heard and what time you heard it. And don't tell us over the air. Report it to rfi@arrl.net. rfi@arrl.net is where you should report it. Sometimes the signal that you're hearing through the repeater sounds very loud, but at your particular location, it might be a very weak signal. When you go to the reverse mode, if you are using an all-mode transceiver that has a single sideband mode, you therefore can get a much weaker signal determination in the sideband mode. So the fact that you go to the reverse mode and don't hear it, don't just simply give up. If you've got a rig that has a dropper, if you have a transceiver,
figure out combat address and all that.
very interested in wanting to know his research. I don't know about it. It's a public business. Thank you, sir. Let me drive it.
Talking about the
repair on the ammonia system. The ammonia system throughout the space station is a cooling. They don't use freon, but they use ammonia. They circulate that. And then they have heat exchangers on the inside to take care of, you know, removing natural heat from the all the electronics and the tremendous amount of heat that gets inside the space station, but they have to get it out before you see not only panels all over for electricity, but you see panels for heat radiation all over the space station. So if there was a leak in the pumping, one of the pumps that they have, and it was out on the P6 truss segment. That's all the way at the end. They have, you know, P2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and they have S2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So yes, you know, sent to stop it, and P is port, so this thing was way out on the left-hand side. So they did have a spare pump there. They had molded the old setup, put the new one in, and stay there while NASA turned everything back on and got everything running, the pump circulating, and they do not have any leaks. So this thing creeped up on Thursday, and here we are Sunday. Actually, yesterday they fixed it. So I watched as much of the spacewalk as I could, and the other part, drop it. The other part that I didn't see, they had on tape, so you could actually go back and look at Ustream and watch the NASA space war. They did very, very good. There's a six-man crew up there now. And check out on the... You know, this is standard procedure now. Generally, you either have three or six up there. Interesting that we have people from Canada that listen to this repeater. When they realize that for the last 4 months or so, you had a first time you had a Canadian commander. It's always either been Russian or an American. So his tour is over. Today they have a handle, official handle, and Expedition 35 will be taking over. Let me drop it. Yeah, he'll be coming back, I think, tomorrow. Probably the day that they leave, they get into the Soyuz space station and do some talk, and they'll come back, man, and Kazakhstan, him and the other two crewmates that went up there for the last 4 months or so. So, so much for manned space program, doing very good. I was talking about an earlier satellite. You can email me and ask about any satellites we have in orbit constantly going up, or the ones that are doing interplanetary missions or going to moon. I don't know about it. We'll research it. And you can go to that website if you didn't get it before with all the experiments, spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. I'm dropping it. Rich, how am I making the repeater?
Very well. 98% copy. So, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Spacenetreport, all of us together, @gmail.com is your email address. Is that true, Paul?
Yes, that is true. Very good. And that one spacecraft episode I mentioned that before, the LEGO back in the 1970s, and LAGOS, and of course that's another acronym, but what they did is it's got a bunch of corner reflectors. I mean, a lot of them all small. Actually, there was two of them that were set up, one in the 70s and one in the 90s, and they're about 800 pounds, and what they do is just, you send up lasers and come back, and you can accurately measure the distance between you and the satellite. once I have a continental drift, structural earthquake study and things like this. There's thousands of satellites going up all the time. That's pretty much what I have. Curiosity's gotten is back running, as well as all the other spacecraft that at Mars. They've been out of touch all April, and things are looking good. Curiosity's going to go to Mount Sharp. Mount Sharp is the destination after it drills into another rock in a week or two. It'll be freed up for a long journey, about a 5-mile journey, to get to Mount Sharp. And it will start investigating that mountain. That's pretty much it. Again, if anybody wants to contact me, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you for the TechNet. This is WS2S.
Very fine, Paul. Good copy. 98% of everything we heard. One of the questions I've got for you, Paul, Mr. Richard Brunson, Virgin Atlantic, I know he's got people signing up to go to space, and he's also got people signing up for a one-way mission. I think it's his one-way mission to Mars. And I believe in both cases, thousands of people are signing up and putting up a down payment. So give us a couple of words on that. First of all, do you know roughly how many people have signed up for his space adventure and how much a down payment are they putting? And I think it is him, but maybe it's somebody else that are also signing up people for a one-way mission to Mars, in which, again, there are thousands of people who have signed up for this thing. And I think they're putting down a down payment. So if you're familiar with either one of these, and I think one or two of them were on the news in the last week or so, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And I have a question for Paul.
Roger, but Paul first, go ahead, Paul.
Let me see if I have it, but I kept it telling. Okay, I'll assume I got one. Yeah, two different groups. Richard Branson, he's the one out in he's building a spaceport out in Mexico, but right now they're testing the covered the last week. He's got the spaceship two, they call it. He tested it out in Mojave Desert out in California last week and successfully launched the from the White Knight carrier. They carry it to 40,000 feet, 45,000 feet, drop it and lit its engine and go off for about 16 seconds to about 55,000 feet. So they're on their way. Hopefully by the end of the year, they'll be making our flights. Got a couple more tests to do before he does that. And once he does it, he'll be able to do it on a regular basis. Come down, land, refuel, and go up maybe the next day. Who knows? I mean, he's got ambitious plans on doing this. 500 people have signed up. They're going to pay $200,000 a blast to drop it. We covered it a little bit last week, but it's fun to talk about. $200,000 to go to a suborbital flight. Yeah, it's roughly an hour and a half or so adventure. You know, you get into the spaceship 2, you're attached to White Knight 2. There's carrier jet planes, like 747, 7.5, a hole in the thing. It takes off and brings up to 45,000 feet, and then instead of having an engine launch in 16 seconds, you're going to launch for a lot longer time than that. You'll get up to about maybe 4,000 miles per hour, and you'll be into out of space, which is a little over 100 kilometers high. Do some weightlessness for a while and then come on back down and then land on a runway into Mexico. That's one group. That's Branson. Richard Branson is doing that, which is Galactic Airlines or Galactic, whatever it is, company. Let me drop it. Another group comes out of the Netherlands called Mars One. I don't know how I feel about this one. I've read a lot about him in the last couple of years, and he's trying to organize like a general contract, you might say, He's going to try to get all these companies together. You're going to build the launch. You're going to have a vehicle that's going to do interplanetary habitation. Another group is going to do the landing. And you're not coming back. And first mission scheduled for 2023. He's going to send four people there. Well, he doesn't have a rocket. He doesn't have nothing. He's raising money. I'll try to read more about this. It sounds like he's a fundraiser. And he's got 78,000 people that have already signed up for this. And what they signed up for is an application. So that's why I'm a little skeptical of this. Depending on what country you come from, you're going to pay a different price for this application. You drop it. United States, $37. Now you put your $37 down. Now you get an application. Now you're not picked yet. You know, here you got 78,000. Maybe within a year, you're going to have a couple hundred thousand people that you're competing against. And they're going to whittle it down here and whittle it down there. And eventually, they're going to have, at the end, it's going to be like one of these reality shows. And the public is, or the people that have put their money down, I don't know, they're going to vote and they're going to figure out who's going to go. And these football people will take off someday in the future and land on Mars and not come back. But they should be happy because there's more people like them that signed up that are going to be coming 2 years down the road, actually 26 months down the road. And every 26 months, more and more people will come to join them. But that's it. You better bring your wife, kids, dog, I don't know what, because you ain't coming back. What are you up to?
Wow. 78,000 people have signed up, made application, $37 per application. Even that's a good piece of change just to start off with. Eventually it's going to be whittled down to four people who actually go to Mars the first time, and then every 26 months another launch. 78,000 people one way to Mars, and 500 people $200,000 to go to space for 1.5 hours, 100 kilometers. Wow. Hey, John, is it me, or do we have a fair number of crazies here? KC2WGB, I know you got a further question. Somehow I suspect you're not signing up for this, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I think you'd have to fail a mental test to sign up for that. Yeah, I do have a question for Paul. The ammonia leak, the coolant leak that we had on the spacecraft, do they have to resupply? Is it a problem, or do they have enough to continue? Do you know how many pounds we lost, and is it going to be a problem? Back to you, Dick.
And as I turn it over to you, Paul, I presume the ammonia leak, if it was inside the spacecraft, I know they'd be smelling it. If the leak was on the outside of the International Space Station, I think they first noticed a bunch of snowflakes dropping outside. I think that was the clue. So maybe we should be happy if the ammonia leak was outside, not inside, because inside, I think depending on the concentration of ammonia, first of all, it's not only unpleasant, but I think it's slightly toxic. So, and John's asking, if I understand correctly, how many pounds of ammonia leak, and do they have a spare tank of it that they can just pour back in to fill up the reservoir again? WS2M, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it isn't as much. It wasn't like this big leak, but I mean, they saw the snowflakes coming out. How they call it. And I don't know how many pounds. I don't know. It was a couple of few pounds. It was not much, you know. They shut it. What happens is they shut it down. They run the pump. They actually pull it back in the line. So they pretty much really remove most of the ammonia from the system before they work on it and crack it open. And they were able to repair it, put it back together, and put back it's a reservoir, with any pumping system.
system to do this. You know, it's got to be piped to the radiated back down to the heat exchanges that it took up the actual heat. Actually, the other way around. Go from the heat, you know, the heat exchanges up to the radiators, and then they pull it back to the pump. And it's not a compression system. It's actually a loop. It's liquid. It's, you know, when I first read about this all 20 years ago, I thought they were going to use ammonia in a refrigerant style where they were going to have, you know, thermostatic expansion valves and red then, you know, evaporators and condensers, and that's not the case. It's just that you're running a fluid to, you know, one end to the other. I mean, ammonia is a great refrigerant, which water is something like 940 BTU per pound, per liquid pound, and ammonia is about half of it. So I thought, oh, well, maybe that's what they're going to do, but it's not. It's just that ammonia won't freeze in a vacuum, and they use it, you know, for that purpose. It won't freeze going through their system. So they just use, you know, using the ammonia as a circulating type of deal. Keep everything cool. It wasn't affecting the operation of the space station. Each cell panel has one of these things, pumps, you know, connected to it. So you have four on the left side, four on the private side. So you have plenty of cooling. Not a problem. But did you see where they were working? Let me drop it. They're working all the way at the end. I mean, at one point I saw the. It looks like the solar panels are still turning. They must have shut them down. I haven't heard of what they did. And these things turn at a rate of once every hour and a half. So every orbit. I just can't imagine that they'd be working out with this thing hovering over their head as it's turning closer and closer to them as the hours go by. So they must have shut them down, or at least that side down. I mean, the whole International Space Station was built like this, you know, with everything on the outside, all these data connectors and power connectors and ammonia systems, where the mirror system was the other way around. So this way they have all the infrastructure outside and nothing on the inside. It gives them more room on the inside. But they have to go out and fix it. Now, if you have a leak and the ammonia was on the inside, which is not, let me drop. You would know it. I mean, you know, you smell ammonia, and you know what that smells like. You get surprised by, like, I remember working on a Coca-Cola in Colorado, and they welded a cooling tower together, and part of it had an aluminum pipe, you know, it had an ammonia system going through the piping, and somewhere, and it would leak, you know, I was near the thing, and boy, I tell you, it was like somebody took a nail and drove it up my nose, so you would know it right away, but they don't have the stuff floating around on the inside of the space station. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I can see why you'd want to use ammonia instead of water. If you did freeze water in those pipes, and water has got this nasty characteristic that when it freezes, it expands and will burst pipes, that could make life very, very difficult. And ammonia, I guess, not only doesn't freeze at these temperatures, but maybe when ammonia does freeze, maybe it's not one of these substances that expands when it freezes. I believe that the rush to do the spacewalk, to do the pump repair, had to be up until Sunday because the astronaut who has the most amount of experience with spacewalking is the astronaut that's due to come home this coming Monday or Tuesday, if I understand correctly, Paul. So, is that correct? And do you think that outside, or was it a pipe interconnection on the outside that was leaking? Did they say what exactly, you know, what was the leak? Two questions there for WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm switching back and forth. I'm going to repeat it here. I don't know if that was the case, but they could, if they wanted to keep them up there, they could keep them up there a little longer. In fact, they're going to start having one year flights by Americans now. That's going to start happening, I think, 2 years from now. The connection, I don't know if it was, they said it was coming from the bottom of the pump, the bottom of the pump, the controlling pump, so maybe there's a valve or something, a valve on the pump that might be leaking. I don't know. I don't know if it was the actual transmission pieces between the pump and the rest of the station, the radiators. I mean, just by listening to them, it sounded like it was part of the pump controlling unit, which is sound like valves probably on the bottom of the thing. Don't know. In fact, they didn't know yet. They're going to eventually get this thing back in. Another space walk will be done. You know, for various reasons. I mean, they're up to 140 different spacewalks now, maybe more. And another one will be done, probably as, you know, while you're out there, bring this pump back in, and maybe they'll send it back on a Dragon or something, and NASA will have a good look at it. Maybe they'll even be able to look at it inside the space station. I predict that will happen someday. But all the infrastructure, again, is outside. Space station's now going to stay up. I read not till 2020, but 2028. Let me drop. International Space Station now is going to stay up till at least 2028. Not 2020 as it was a couple of years ago. It's going to be up there a long time, and eventually Russians want to take some of their parts apart, and they want to use it on their new space station that they have planned. So these parts better last a long time. Back to you, Dick.
Well, let me do a quick check. Yes. When I'm transmitting on the eastern input, I'm switching the western input with a little bit of delay. I'm coming out of the east. When I transmit it out of the east, I come out of the west. So you said you're flipping back and forth on repeaters. I'm a little curious as to why. Question number one. Question number two, what was the original, way back in the dark ages, predicted life of the International Space Station? Was it something like 2015? And now they're predicting to use it until 2028, which makes a lot more sense. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, first of all, I'm not hearing the courtesy tone on this repeater. And the second, I'll unkey, say, back to net, and now I don't hear you, so I think I either timed it out, you didn't hear me turn it over to you, or whatever. I hear nothing. So then I go back to Glen Oaks, and then I hear you talking. So, you know. But meanwhile, my antenna's not turning the other way, so now I gotta go back to Dublin to transmit. So that's what I'm doing there. Yeah, initially, it was supposed to be a 15-year payroll for 15 years. It started in 1998 is when they first sent up the first piece, but due to the delays, I think they wanted it originally completed probably in 2001 or something like that, or 2002, but it didn't happen. So it would have went to 2015.